Hi ladies, welcome to session 9 of CPRT. So close to the end, and that's exciting for me to know that we're coming to the end of the semester, but also that you all are almost done with the learning piece of this training, and you'll then be able to conduct it in the future feeling more confident and knowing that you've done it once, so everything's easier the second time and after that. So we're happy that we're getting to the end. So let's go ahead and jump in. We're going to obviously go through from the manual and two rules of thumb today. And so the first is when there are no limits, there is no security. And session 9 goes into advanced limit setting. So this is a continuation and almost a 2.0, if you will, of the limit setting, and it takes it into a few different directions and helps parents understand when and how they would use different types of limits. So we're actually kind of circling back. I mean, obviously limit setting was week 4, and now we're circling back week 9. So this rule of thumb is specific to limits because it's important to help parents understand that limits provide security. And the explanation there is that when there is consistency in limits, there is security in the relationship for the child. And if the parent does not follow through, they lose credibility, and then also that harms the relationship between them and their children. So when there are no limits, there is no security. That's a really crucial piece. And it's actually helpful to kind of revisit the limit setting week because it was so long ago. It's helpful for them to be re-energized about it and almost be reminded about the importance of it, and maybe in a fresh and new way with some of these new examples. So when there's no limits, there's no security. The second rule of thumb is don't try to change everything at once. And I think that this training is laid out well in so much as it does allow the parents to focus on one thing at a time. So I think that's already been modeled for them. But mentally, it's important for them to understand that big issues, and big is in quotes because I know big is relative, but focusing on big issues that ultimately will mean the most to the child's development of positive self-esteem and feelings of competence and usefulness is always more important than trying to address and remedy little things and, you know, problem behaviors, issues, concerns, etc. This training and the skills that they're learning in this training focus on positive self-esteem, feelings of competence and usefulness. And long term, those are far more important than some of the day-to-day or week-to-week issues that they may have, such as, you know, my child doesn't listen or my child talks back. Those are little issues compared to the bigger development of the child and what happens long term and preparation for adulthood. So those are the rules of thumb. And once you cover those with parents, if you'll flip with me, we will get into the advanced limit setting section. So these next two pages, it's essentially one big example and then one big practice, and then a blank section where the parent can fill in a situation that they think the child may not comply with a limit during a play session. So this is essentially the precursor to the following pages. And what I have found is I don't really spend a whole lot of time on these two pages because the next two are more significant and more important. And so for time's sake, I tend to summarize these two a little bit. So essentially with the example, the child wants to play with the Play-Doh and dumps it out on the floor. So it goes through the ACT scenario of the Play-Doh limit. And then it says that Billy continues to ignore the parent and continues to smash the Play-Doh on the floor. Now, they mention that the parent may patiently restate the limit up to 3 times before the if-then choices kick in. Essentially, the if-then choices, or another word for that would be the consequences, the if-then choices for following or not following the limit is essentially what we call the ultimate limit. And I know that I've probably mentioned that before, but that is essentially what you're training the parents in this week, is you can restate that limit up to 3 times. After that third time, the ultimate limit kicks in, which is the if-then slash consequence piece of limit setting. So the next step there is you're providing consequence for unacceptable behavior. So, and if you remember from the Cookies, Choices, and Kids video, Dr. Landreth talked a lot about how many times you use the word choose, and that is reiterated here as well. So the intention is that the child gets himself or herself under control, and therefore patience is the order of the day. Children need time and practice to develop self-control. That is not something that comes naturally. And I was actually just speaking with a parent in the last few weeks, and we had a discussion about, depending on the age of the child, some younger children need as much as 120 seconds to process something in conversation. Because remember, kids are not intellectual beings, they're not verbal beings, they're not cognitive beings, and they're not verbal beings. So having a conversation where they have to think about something, it takes them into their heads. And remember, this training talks about kids live in their emotions and in their hearts. So 120 seconds. And trust me, when you're waiting for a child to make a decision, 120 seconds feels like 120 minutes. So it can be really challenging, and it can be a struggle for parents to extend the patience that allows the child to make the choice for themselves. Because it's far easier and far quicker to just swoop in and insist that the child do what you want them to do. You know, you could just rip the Play-Doh out of the kid's hand, but that does not give the child the opportunity to practice self-control. And sometimes you have to be patient way longer than you feel like you want to or need to. But that's why it says patience is so important there, because they need time to practice that. So then they go through the example. And I won't read that because you all can read that with your parents. But essentially, the if-then statement after you set ACT looks like you've chosen to put the Play-Doh up for today. You can choose to give me the Play-Doh, or you can choose for me to put the Play-Doh up for you. Which do you choose? Now, obviously, this comes on the heels of, if you choose to continue to play with the Play-Doh on the floor, you choose not to play with the Play-Doh for the rest of the day. If you choose to not play with the Play-Doh on the floor, you choose to play with the Play-Doh for the rest of the day. That has already been stated. Then they made the choice, in this case, to continue to play with the Play-Doh on the floor. So then consequence comes in for non-compliance, which is, I see you've chosen to put the Play-Doh up for today. Now, here's the interesting twist. They get another choice. And I know several of you have mentioned, you know, your parents are asking, well, what do you do when they make this decision? Well, here it finally comes back full circle, and they're given the opportunity to see what you do. So you give them another choice. So then the choice becomes no longer playing with it on the floor or not playing with it on the floor. Then it becomes giving the parent the Play-Doh, or choosing for the parent to put the Play-Doh up for the child. So notice that it still is returning responsibility. It's still allowing the child a measure of control. And of course, just like from the video and from this training, you know, the child will probably begin to cry and beg to have the Play-Doh still. And then you still remind them that they acknowledge and reflect the feeling. I know that you wish you would have chosen not to put the Play-Doh on the floor. Or, I understand that you're unhappy that you chose to have the Play-Doh put up for today, but you can choose to play with it in our next play session. So circle back to reflecting feeling, week one. And you continue to validate that. I know that you're unhappy. I know you wish you would have chosen. I know you wish you could still play with the Play-Doh. I know you're upset that you chose to lose the Play-Doh for today. You just validate that, encourage them to really hone in on the emotions. And now, here's an important piece of this. If the child decided to stop playing with it on the floor, the parent will also acknowledge that choice too. So parents must be careful to respond, "I see you decided you wanted to play with the Play-Doh some more today." Because the child also needs to hear how important it is that they made the choice to continue to play with the Play-Doh, just as they need to hear they made the choice not to continue to play. So the child's decision is acknowledged verbally either way. Okay, so you're gonna go over that with them, then there's a practice. It goes back to the dart gun example. I personally would love to have other options. I feel like we've exhausted the dart gun example. But I suppose if we're thinking of this in terms of practice, it is helpful for the parent to get the same scenario to practice. So, child aims the loaded dart gun at the parent. They go through the ACT process just like normal. Then they continue three more times. So then ultimate limit kicks in. So then the parent gets to practice that. If you choose to, and theirs is blank, but they're trying to communicate, if you choose to keep pointing the gun at me, if you choose to aim it at me, if you choose to keep pointing it in my direction, whatever that limit would be, then you choose to not play with the gun. If you choose to aim the gun somewhere else, if you choose to not point the gun at me, if you choose to aim it at the wall, whatever, you choose to get to play with the gun. So there's the if you choose, then you choose statements, ultimate limit. And the child aims and shoots anyway. So then the response would be, "I see you've chosen not to play with the gun." If the child points at the wall, the ceiling, anywhere else, or puts the gun down, it looks like you decided to shoot that. Or I see you chose to continue to have the gun. Or I see you decided to point it over there. And in either case, remember, the parent acknowledges those verbally, those choices, whichever one that looks like. So you practice that with them. Then the next section is the number two, where they get to fill in their own. That is very unique to the parent. And so if you're working one-on-one, obviously you can go over that with them. If you have multiple people in the group, they get the opportunity to fill that in on their own. And then you can possibly talk about that, but that is for them to kind of just do that as a personal thing. So now moving into the bigger piece of this week. So flip the page with me. Now, here is the generalizing limit setting to outside the play session, because most of the examples, if not all of them, have been specifically about in the play session. So same process again, ACT. Three steps, reminder of what they learned week four. So the scenario in this case is the child found a hidden stash of candy, has a piece in his hand, and is starting to unwrap it, but the key is that it's 30 minutes before dinner. So you're going to walk them through the ACT process, and it's really just a recap. So use the information there as much or as little as you want. And so I know you'd really like to have the candy, but candy is not for eating before dinner. You can choose to have a piece of fruit now and choose to have the piece of candy after dinner. Okay, so then just as if you did that week four, that would be the ACT. Then it moves into the choice giving as consequences for the non-compliance. So Billy continues to say that he doesn't want the fruit, he wants candy. So he's not giving up on the wanting the candy. So then you move to if you choose, then you choose statements. So Billy, having candy now is not one of the choices. You can choose to give me the candy now and choose to eat it after dinner, or you can choose for me to put the candy up and choose not to have the candy after dinner. Which do you choose? And they make the note that the parent pauses there. And in this particular scenario, Billy does not respond. So then the parent would say, if you choose not to choose, you choose for me to choose for you. That's a new phrase for them, and that's significant for them to understand, because sometimes the child will say, well, how about I have a granola bar? Well, they're still choosing not to choose because they're not choosing one of the available options. Or sometimes the child will say nothing, which in either scenario, they're still choosing not to choose. So that phrase is very important. When the child will not comply with one of the choices offered, then parents should say, if you choose not to choose, you choose for me to choose for you. And yes, again, they're saying the word choose four times. So there's consistency there. Okay, so then they pose two options. The first is Billy gives the parent the candy. So then the parent would respond, I know that was a hard decision, or I know that you didn't want to make that choice. I'll put the candy up here for you after dinner. I would argue that they should say, I'll put it up here for you after dinner since you chose to have it after dinner. Because I think it's important to actually have the child hear the words, you chose to have it after dinner, to reinforce the consequence. Then Billy continues to hold on to the candy because remember, it was in his hand. So kids will ball up their fists and won't let anyone have what's in them. So I see you've chosen for me to choose for you. That's the acknowledgement of the choice that was made. And then the parent reaches for the candy to put it away. And of course, they take the candy away. Then Billy comes up after dinner and says, what? Now can I have the candy? Because he's aware that it was after dinner was when the candy was the option. And so the parent would say, when you chose, just like from the Cookies, Choices, and Kids video, remember when you chose not to give me the candy before dinner, that's when you chose not to have the candy after dinner. At that very moment is the crucial phrase there. So when you chose not to give me the candy before dinner, it was at that very moment that you chose not to have the candy after dinner. And there's the connection made for the child of immediacy of decision and therefore outcome as well. So the child may plead and cry and be very upset. And the encouragement there is for the parents to be firm and not give in. And so then it moves into the practice. The practice is the helpful piece of this because it actually kind of gets them expanding on the skills they've already built and giving them practice with some of the new phrasing and some of the new things that you're teaching today. So the practice scenario is it's a school night and the child wants to watch 30 minutes of TV before going to bed and his favorite Charlie Brown special is coming on next. So help them talk through the ACT process. That should be the simpler part. And then it continues that they would restate the limit three times. Billy does not comply. So it's a reminder here, parents remain empathic, calm, but firm. Those three traits are extremely important in this process. So empathic, calm, and firm. I wish we had time to watch Charlie Brown, but it's bedtime. Or I know you'd really like to watch Charlie Brown. Or I know Charlie Brown is your favorite. Or I know you'd like to stay up 30 more minutes. I mean, there's so many directions that that can go because they're focusing on what the child is really communicating. So I know that you'd like to watch Charlie Brown, but it's time for bed. You can choose to watch it tomorrow after school. Well, it is very difficult because the immediate need of the child is to watch it and tomorrow seems like an eternity. So, you know, there's still an issue there. And the comment is it may help to refocus the child to bedtime by giving him a choice related to the bedtime routine. So do you choose for me or mom to read you a story tonight? That would, just like the pointing redirects attention, well, this would be the redirection of attention through another choice related to bedtime. So there is an example and a practice for the scenario where, you know, followed by the consequences for noncompliance. Okay? And then flip the page. This next page actually kind of talks through some scenarios. And I feel that some of you have shared parents are asking questions that you're not really sure how to answer and you don't really know how that scenario would unfold in a practical sense. I think this page single-handedly might address a lot of those questions on both sides, so on the parent side and on your side. So they've actually talked through on this sheet some of the scenarios that can happen when they're setting limits with their kids. So the first, number one, is if you are satisfied with your response to the child's question and the question or plea is repeated. So, can I please just have 30 more minutes? You set the limit. No, but I mean, it's only 30 minutes and I don't have to get up that early for school anyway and I won't be tired at all, and can I please just watch 30 more minutes? Okay, so if the parent is satisfied with the response to the child's question that's already been given, meaning in this case, it's bedtime, don't discuss. That is kind of the foundational principle of the entire scenario. You just don't discuss it because you're already satisfied, even though they're continuing to repeat it. Okay, now, there could be other scenarios. If the parent thinks the child doesn't understand their response, meaning the parent set the limit, but they're not convinced the child fully grasps what was said, then the option would be to say, I've already answered that question. You must have a question about my answer. That's really important, because if the child's pleading, it's one thing to assume they're just not accepting it, but if the parent has any indication that the child is confused or doesn't really understand, that's when they would say, I've already answered that question. You must have a question about my answer. Okay, or more often than not, probably, the parent thinks that the child does understand. Okay, then there are three options. I can tell you'd like to discuss this some more, but I've already answered that question. So that would be one option. The second would be, I can tell you don't like my answer. If you're asking again because you want me to change my mind, I will not change my mind. That's a very helpful one because you're reflecting feelings in that scenario. I can tell you don't like my answer, or I can tell you're unhappy with the answer I gave you or whatever. But if you're asking again because you're hoping I'll change my mind, I will not. And my husband and I actually use not that exact phrase, but we communicate that message to our son a lot. When he keeps asking and asking, we'll say, no matter how many times you choose to ask, we're not changing our minds. So that is a very succinct and clear way to communicate to the child that you can continue to ask, but it's not going to change anything. Okay? Then the third option would be, do you remember the answer I gave you a few minutes ago when you asked the same question? It always circles back to the child's responsibility for regulating on their own. And oftentimes kids will say, no, I don't remember, even if they do, or because they weren't really listening to the answer in the first place because it wasn't the one they wanted. So if the child answers, no, I don't remember, the parent can say, go sit down in a quiet place and think. I know you'll be able to remember. And then that gives the child the space to regroup and realize they do in fact know what the answer is. They just weren't accepting it. All right. So then those are the three scenarios where, you know, if the parent genuinely feels satisfied, there's no discussion. If the child does not understand the response, the parent responds in a way that allows for them to process it. If the child does understand, there's three ways to make it very clear that what was said, and there's no changing of that. Now, number four is if the parent is not satisfied with the child, with the response to the child's question. So then there are some scenarios here. If the parent is open to persuasion, so let me think of a scenario. Child comes running up. It's car circle time. They're getting ready to go home. And the child comes running up and says, can I go over to Johnny's house because we're going to work on a project together? Okay. The parent might immediately say no just because it catches them off guard and they weren't prepared for the question. And, you know, out of just kind of knee-jerk reaction, they say no. But if the child starts to talk about it more and the parent realizes, well, you know what, maybe it would be okay for them to go over, the parent's open to persuasion. So then the parent would say, I don't know, let's sit down and discuss this. Okay. So another scenario would be if the parent intends to answer the question later but cannot answer it then the parent can say, I can't answer that question now because, and give the reason why. So I need more information. I need time to think about it. I need to talk to your parent, your other parent, etc. I will let you know and give a specific time. So I'll let you know later this afternoon, or I'll let you know tomorrow, or I'll let you know next week. Kids need specificity of time, because without doing that, it seems that there's a never-ending perpetual waiting for the answer. So if the parents open a persuasion, let's sit down and discuss it. If they want to answer the question, but just not at that time, then there's that option. Now, the third and final would be if the child demands an answer now. So, no, you really need to tell me right this second. I have to go tell their mom right now, and I have to know right this second. Then the parent can say, if you must have an answer now, the answer will have to be no. And that makes it very clear if the parent isn't comfortable with the immediate answer, then by default, the answer will be no. And most of the time kids will say, okay, well, how long do you need? And then it changes the whole scene. So those are some scenarios, and I think that's helpful for parents to have some vocabulary and some phrases to use when those types of situations occur. All right, so now there are seven, this next bracket here, there are seven things to do when limit setting does not work. And, you know, just like any other discipline method, just like any other skill parents use, it is not foolproof. It is not 100% effective all of the time. So when limit setting does not work, there are seven suggestions that they have. So in these scenarios, the parent would have several times calmly and empathically done the ACT and the choices. And the child just continually and deliberately disobeys. So what do you do? And I know several parents mentioned questions like this. So here's their answer. The first would be look for natural causes for rebellion. So fatigue, sickness, hunger, stress, etc., all of those play a big, big role in disobedience. That is 100% true with our son. If he is tired or hungry, we know 100%. I mean, if his behavior escalates to a degree where it's rare for him to act like that, without fail, he's either tired or hungry, across the board, always. And while it doesn't make the behavior any more acceptable, it helps the parent to meet the child in that moment and understand why. Because if I can, as a mom, say, you know what, he's extremely hungry, and then we address that need before we address the behavior, everything is better. And almost always, once he eats a few bites, he's back to normal and everything is fine again. So same thing with going to sleep. Goes to sleep, wakes up, and everything's fine. So take care of the physical needs and crises before expecting cooperation. That's huge for parents. And it seems too simple. And some parents will say, yeah, but I mean, even when they're hungry, they still need to be able to obey. Eventually, absolutely. But as they're learning and as their bodies are still figuring out how to remain in control, you always have to give them a little bit of, you know, acceptance there related to behavior. Okay, so natural causes of rebellion, very important. Second is remaining in control on the parent side. So not only do the parents need to respect themselves, they need to respect their children. And parents will often turn that on themselves when their child does not obey. And so it makes it very clear, the parent is not a failure if the child rebels or disobeys. And the child is not bad. That's another very important distinction. So every child practices being disobedient. Every kid. They learn about boundaries, they learn about limits, they learn about how the world operates, they learn about consequences, they learn about outcomes. So every single child practices rebelling. So in the moment, even when the child is disobedient or disrespectful or whatever the scenario is, Nothing is more important than the relationship with the child. So responding in a way that respects that relationship is extremely important. And there's a note, if the parent finds themselves feeling angry and losing control, leave. Walk outside, go to another room, take a break. Preservation of the relationship is far more important. So parents have to remain in control and be respectful. 3, set reasonable consequences for disobedience. So here's, we're going back to that principle, the child chooses to obey or disobey. And the parents need to let their child make that choice. But there should be a reasonable consequence for disobedience. So the example there is if you choose to watch TV instead of going to bed, then you choose to give up TV all day tomorrow. That's a reasonable consequence. But it does make a note, the consequence has to be meaningful for the child. I usually talk about it in terms of the child's currency. So you have to figure out what motivates kids. And so if parents can hone in on, wow, TV is really important, or allowance money is really important, or friends, time with friends is really important, or, you know, whatever. What matters to the child? It's their currency. So it needs to be appropriate and meaningful both. 4, never tolerating violence. Physically restraining a child that is becoming violent is the first course of action before anything else takes place, although the parent cannot become aggressive themselves. And you reflect the child's anger, and essentially the parent is showing empathy while still making sure that everyone is safe as the child regains control. Okay, 5, if the child refuses to choose, the parents choose for the child. We already went over it, but they kind of go into it in more depth. The child's refusal to choose is a choice. So by doing nothing, by saying nothing, by continuing to argue and not making a choice, that is also a choice. And setting the consequence is important. So then it would be if you choose not to choose A or B, then you've chosen for me to choose for you. And it's wordy, but it communicates a very specific message. Okay, 6, enforce the consequences. The parent cannot state consequences that they cannot enforce, or they completely lose their efficacy. So then it says, if the parent crumbles under the child's anger or tears, you've abdicated your role as parent and lost power. So, you know, many, many kids have figured out that if I cry or if I whine or if I throw something or if I argue or if I get angry or fill in the blank of behavior, mom, dad, whomever gives in. Well, the parent has to be tough. And if the parent does not follow through, not only do they lose credibility, but it harms the relationship. Because remember, we're going to cycle back to rule of thumb. When there are limits, there are security. And so the security comes from consistency and follow through. So those are really important. And then finally, 7, recognizing signs of more serious problems. If there has been grief, stress, neglect, abuse, trauma of any kind, depression, the chronically angry or rebellious child is in emotional trouble and might need professional help. We're not talking about, you know, a kid that's hungry or tired or bored or sick or whatever and, you know, has meltdowns and tantrums. We're talking about a child who is chronically struggling, perpetually rebellious, angry to an unnecessary degree. That's a child that may need professional help. And that would be an instance where the parent would share the concern with the child. And there's an example there. You know, John, I've noticed that you seem to be angry and unhappy. I love you and I'm worried about you. We're going to get help so we can all be happier. And that would be a step that's made once the parent realizes that there's something deeper going on and it's important to get that addressed. So that is 9, aside from this next 2 optional pages here. I choose personally and professionally to not even print the structured doll play for parents section. I don't feel that it is necessarily helpful or relevant. So I just eliminate it. You can choose to use it, but structured doll play has never been something that I've included when I train CPRT. So that's just my choice. But you can feel free to read over it and decide if you want to use it, but I choose not to. So go ahead and go back with me to the very first page so we can review the homework for the parents, because that's all of the curriculum for week 9. So homework assignments are the generalizing the limit setting to outside the play session practice. So just like before, they're going to report on a time they used the ACT outside of the play session and practice the if-then statements that we just went over. The second homework assignment is notice the number of times that the parent touches the child in interactions outside of the play session. And that can be hugging, touching on the head, touching on the arm, holding hands, whatever that looks like, any kind of physical contact outside of the play session. They're just supposed to keep count. Then a related assignment is the option of play wrestling. And it's essentially just like it sounds. I mean, you know, it says mom and kids can sneak up on dad. You know, it just makes it fun. It's fun. It's laughter. It's physical touch. It's just having fun together, wrestling, goofing around. It could be a pillow fight. It could be something like that. And then choose an issue that the parent is to choose an issue that they're struggling with outside the play session and report back on how you can use the play session skills to respond to the issue. Some parents will say, I really don't have any issues, and that's okay. But if they do, then you can talk about it. Obviously, they conduct the play session, and then the reminder is for them to write the third and final note to the child of focus, varying how the note is delivered with the same template and the same positive character quality sheet that they're going to pick from. So that is it. That is all of session 9. I hope that it goes well for you when you conduct this with your families, and I'll look forward to seeing you in the Zoom meeting this week. See you soon. Bye.